Monster Professor.
Welcome to the Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. Except I have to take that last title away today. I'm not really the monster expert. Not when I'm compared to my guest today, Joseph Nigg. If you know anything about him or his many books on fabulous beasts, then you know what I know and have known for many years, that he's the real monster professor around here. At least I've thought so, and many others have as well. He's an expert who has book after book after book on fabulous beasts. In fact, his book titled The Book of Fabulous Beasts, 1999 out of Oxford University Press, that's the one that first really drew my eye to him. In this collection of source materials, everything from the ancient Babylonian Enuma Elish all the way up to the modern writers on tracks the history of fabulous beasts like the dragon, the phoenix, the griffin, the unicorn, and this is a guy who really gets it. And then the more I looked up into him and saw his other works, the more that was absolutely proved true. And so I'll try to give you a quick rundown of his many books. He's got The Phoenix, an unnatural biography of a mythical beast, University of Chicago Press. That one's not too long ago. Sea Monsters, A Voyage Around the World's Most Beguiling Map, University of Chicago Press. How to Raise and Keep a Dragon, for those of you wanting to know that, 2013. Book of Dragons and Other Mythical Beasts. I've mentioned Book of Fabulous Beasts, which is close to my heart and had a huge influence on me. Wonder Beasts, back in 95, A Guide to Imaginary Birds of the World. The Book of Griffins. These are only his books. He's done many other things as well. He holds a PhD from University of Denver, MFA from Iowa Writers' Workshop, Kent State for his BA. The man is brilliant, and he was extremely generous to sit down and talk with me about fabulous beasts. I really enjoyed this conversation with him, and as I said, it's a great honor and a great pleasure to do so and to get to share that with you. So without further ado, here is my conversation with the great Joseph Nigg.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Well, this is a real pleasure for me to talk to another follower of imaginary creatures. Had a mind-blowing couple of days reading your podcasts. Wow, Josh, what a discovery for me with your... which ones are they? I'm checking my notes. I'm an old guy here. Monsters in Lit blows me away. You have such great scope and depth. And I was realizing that, my God, okay, the book you like so much of mine, I do too. For me, it is a source book, and it's the tip of the iceberg. What you do, is you go sliding down the doggone glacier, which is wonderful. And I am happy that it's a source book. It's a source book for me too, all the time, to go back to and, read things that I've forgotten, the actual line or something, which I did this morning. I am a brother to dragons and a companion to owls. One of my favorite lines of all time. Do you know where it's from?
I'm a brother to dragons. That is That is that from Job?
Yes, it
Yes,
is.
all right.
Yes, it is. And your discussion of Leviathan and Behemoth was just wonderful. I love it. And so that gets me back to Job. Yeah, Job, the most poetic, really,
Oh, yeah.
of the Old Testament, and most loved by English majors and literary folk. Yeah, that description of Leviathan especially is just like what you have in Revelation. Just so dreamlike and wonderful stuff. Oh boy. Okay. Yeah.
Well, it really is, and we're diving into the deep end, almost literally. We're getting into Leviathan, which is exactly where I'd want to go too. But first of all, thank you so much for the kind words. I know you can't see me right now, neither can the listeners, but I'm blushing over here because I have to say it's a huge honor and a huge pleasure to get to talk with you. I on the podcast, I rather cheekily call myself a monster expert, or I just went with the name The Monster Professor. And others have poked fun at me a little bit in the past, saying like, "What right do you have to call yourself the Monster Professor?" And the truth is, as long as you are around, I really have none, because you are the real Monster Professor in my mind, and you have the books to prove it, one book after another. And the book that made the largest impact on me, one that came out in 1999, I believe, was Book of Fabulous Beasts, a treasury of writings from ancient times to the present. And I realized that wasn't the first time I knew of you. I used to watch this show in the 90s, hosted by Leonard Nimoy on A&E, and what was it? Mystery, Ancient Mysteries. And there was a special episode on dragons, which I remember blowing my mind. And you were on there as one of the experts, right? Is that
Yeah,
right?
I was. I prepared for it with about a 15 single spaced page of answers to the questions they were asking me, and I got into it with the interviewer, and she realized, no, just talk to me as though I am your granddaughter. I'm having real trouble here with Tiamat and I was so dependent on what I had written that I was really having trouble, and they cut 99% of the doggone thing. And I did get a couple of lines in it. And I was very professorial sitting next to the fireplace with the tweed jacket and all that.
Yeah, books behind you and
So
everything.
yesterday, preparing for this, I looked at your questions and said, "Hey, Nick, don't do what the heck you did before. Don't write it all out. Let yourself go. And if you screw up, you do somewhere or other. If you take off too far, too many trains going in too many directions." Okay, that's fine. Josh is a young guy; he's forgiving, and so okay. Let's do it this way.
Well, it's that you bring up too many trains going in too many different directions. Not only do I feel like at one point or another, I started worrying that that was a big flaw of mine. I would get so excited about the monster of the episode that I would just jump all over the place. And then I find out listeners are as forgiving to me as I am as a listener to other people. They just like hearing about monsters too.
Oh, absolutely. It is so good to talk to another impassioned follower of these imaginary creatures. It's wonderful. And as a writer, to have somebody read one of your doggone books is astounding. It's just wonderful. Yeah, you sit up here in the scriptorium you're so far out of the world. And it's very nice when there's another voice out there from a different island.
yeah, it really is a pleasure to get to hear from somebody. And just to let the listeners know a little bit more, like, one reason you had such a big impact on me and you're a hero in my mind is this book, Fabulous Beasts, is unlike any other accomplishment that I know of altogether in one book. It essentially tracks the primary, the source material of Fabulous Beasts, starting with, as far as I know, the very earliest pieces of coherent writing that weren't just like grain inventories in Mesopotamia, the Enuma Elish, starting there and going all the way to modern writers tracking some of the most significant fabulous beasts, dragons, griffins, unicorn, the phoenix, and so it's a fantastic treasury, and that's just one of your many, many books. And so one question I've got to know is, what got you into Fabulous Beasts so much? Where did your love and obsession for this come from?
They have enriched my life for the last 40 years. way back, I started in high school sports writing. and got a small scholarship to Kent State and was in journalism. At the end of my junior year, I rather lost my head after reading the Iliad and changed my major to English. I had it in a best masterpieces of the literature course. My father almost disowned me. How in the world are you going to make a living? The head of the department, journalism department, forgave me. I was due to be editor of the Kent Stater next year. I read the Iliad, and Dante's, all his commedia in that course, part of Don Quixote, and so I lost my head. When I went for a recommendation to the head of the English department, he said, "No, I will not give you one. You changed your major." He wouldn't. I think the journalism guy did. But the English head of the English department said, "How many courses have you had in Alexander Pope?" And I said, "Well, I had one." And Whitman was important to me a lot in American lit. Anyway, got accepted at the workshop, squeezed in the workshop at Iowa, started a novel there that I'd been making notes about for some time, of a guy following fantasy, following a spirit of his deceased wife to another world. And then that changed. I got several chapters into it with a wonderful professor, George P. Eliot. Later I went into realistic fiction, with wonderful Vance Pergeli. He was great, with Philip Roth, who finally left without giving me a grade, went back to Berzelii again, and then like the next a couple years after, I was swimming late afternoon, early evening in Lake Huron off Bay City, Michigan, where my parents lived, and the seagull comes down and is just floating, bobbing in front of me, and I slowly swim after it a little with the breaststroke, and it just kept bobbing and bobbing and bobbing, and so I went back to my fantasy, but changed it to a quest for a bird, and it happened to be a firebird. And the first chapter, that took me through most of my 20s writing that. And I had Odysseus, Don Quixote, Jack London, and a modern everyman going in the quest of this firebird in a ship that they build from the constellation Argo. Sail it off the edge of the world. And I thought, this is going to make me famous. Well, it is in a drawer somewhere up here. After many, many, rejections. But the first chapter, is in, on my website. It's called Bird of Wonder. And that was rewritten several times. It's at the back of my website. Wonderful Jeff Vandermeer liked it and used it as the introduction to his Leviathan series way back in 95, and he's been a great supporter ever since. The latest is his wife's collection called Bestiary. And in that, my wife Esther and I collaborated in a wild, wild thing called the Jason bug. Vandermeer and your stuff, the wonderful story of yours of the fight with the monsters. That is just like Vandermeer stuff. And I wonder if you know him, or if you've dealt with him, or if you've been in any of his anthologies, because you're obviously of that quality. My goodness, he's very famous now. You know, his first movie, Annihilation, just came out several months ago. Trilogy, and
yeah, it's funny.
What do you know of Jeff? Jeff or Anne? And
yeah, it's funny. It's funny that you mention him, because he's on my list of people that I hope to invite on the show one day, and I didn't realize you two had a connection there. I've sung his praises in many episodes before. His book Annihilation blew my mind. It's fantastic. In fact,
there we go.
In fact, I did one episode on botanical monsters, and I dedicate a large portion of that to him. And then once I heard he was getting to team up with Alex Garland for the film version of Annihilation. Alex Garland, I consider to be perhaps one of the best screenwriters of our generation. I have a fair bit of hero worship for both of those, actually, but I've never got to meet him or anything.
Son of a gun. Okay, Josh, not showing me at all, right?
Right.
If that's true, and it's only only audio, I would love to light up a pipe, if that's okay. Tolkien often did it while he was being interviewed.
Oh, and, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, thanks. I'm addicted. There is no and have been, God, since my late teens. And
No, I actually really like the idea of imagining getting to talk to Joseph Nigg while he's smoking a pipe. This is just a magical this is a magical moment for me. So you mentioned these birds featuring powerfully in your imagination and then going after this quest. And if I'm not mistaken, you even knew the one of the founding fathers of our idea of the hero's quest, Joseph Campbell. Is that right? Did you?
I interviewed him, right. And it was wonderful. And in fact, before many years before I met him, in the Brown Palace, downtown, which has a Griffin register, up in the wall, for ventilation, whatever, and interviewed him, with another interviewer, sitting in the couch below the Griffin, and I gave him a Griffin book, and I was later in the day, after I went to his lecture at the Natural History Museum. We met in the men's room, and while we were standing there, he said, "Oh, hey, I really enjoyed your book." That was great. I'd given it to him earlier in the afternoon, and it was a highlight of my life. It was wow. All right,
That's
and
amazing.
God, I had dreams about him later, and of me in the parapet of a castle, with the ocean out there, sparkling, and he climbed up the outside with his broad brimmed straw hat, and peeked over and looked at me, and I think maybe there's a telephone involved too. And so I wrote him again, regarding to see if he'd be if he would do a foreword to my imaginary Birds of the World, and he had passed on by then.
Oh, wow.
But
So
so
that's.
it was great. And in fact, I had used his Heroes of All Time or Before You, from Hero of a Thousand Faces as the epigraph for Mondaire, that fantasy that I told you about.
Yeah. Well,
That
that's.
was just the beginning. That was the fictional beginning of my quest. I'd been writing fiction for 20 years, several novels, lots of short stories. Got a few short stories published. I was able to get an MFA at Iowa and then PhD at the University of Denver. And I was on another novel about an unemployed medievalist who takes up residence. Leaves the family and goes and lives in a ship in a children's park. And I did get through the entire first draft of that, but all that time I was writing, I'm looking at this antique oil lamp, which is behind me. I don't know if you can see it or not. Hanging right behind me, right behind the desk. On it is embossed a figure of a winged lion with a fish or dragon tail. And this just burrowed down in my mind, this image over and over. And then January 1, 1980, my boys and I are with family friend in their house, and I'm sitting with one of the daughters who is reading who is showing me a unicorn book she got for Christmas, and at that point, my imagination projected a griffin leaping into the room. And head as high as the ceiling, and great wings. What? I mentioned it in an interview with the Rocky Mountain News, and this is after the Griffin book came out, and a guy comes to the door, and he said, oh, he saw this in the Rocky Mountain News, wanted to say hi. So I invited him, I gave him a glass of wine, and he said, did you really see a griffin? At that point, I'm wondering, where is my escape? How can I get the heck out of here? it wasn't, I would not call it hallucination, but a very, very strong, imaginative projection and probably, a monster from within, just leaps up, I then switched writing from writing on that the novel of the unemployed medievalist. I still have various versions of it, a short story which was so accepted a couple of times not printed, but. I switched from that to researching the griffin, and did. And my wife now, Esther, had worked at the Denver Public Library. Excuse me, not the library, it's the museum. She was a volunteer there and knew of a Persian cup, ancient Persian cup. Silver cup with a griffin embossed on it. Took me down to the storeroom, and they put the white cotton gloves on me, and I held that doggone thing in my hand, going back like at least 3,000 years. And there's a scene in Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark, where what is it burns into the hand of
the icon,
and that got me. So I researched more, started marketing, and a year later, the Griffin book came out, and. And that was the first. So to leap to one of your last questions, which was, what's your all-time favorite monster? Well, I have griffins all over the house, and in the backyard, on the outside plaque on the garage, and so on. So that led me to all the other. Animals, and ultimately to the phoenix. So I would have to answer, what's your all-time favorite? Well, there are two of them. It is Griffin and Phoenix. I have been following off and on between full-time editorial job, and I'm retired now, and several books. Was the Phoenix, the book you have, had an editor, the Oxford editor, chose the Phoenix from a list of books that I had in mind that I would work with. And she chose the Phoenix because she had just been to the Venice Opera House, El Fenice, which had burned, you probably know, several times over the centuries and is rebuilt again and again and again. Most recently, just what, a decade or so. So I started the Phoenix. That was from, yeah, in 1998. So off and on between work and other books, I followed that bird for over 18 years, and that's what I love most about these creatures is following them through time and watching their cultural transformations. All of them do that. They keep changing shape and form, meaning, and it's a way to see patterns. They reflect patterns of history and imagination, and it's a wonderful way to look at history. It's to see how they reflect what is going on in the world itself, whether from the Egyptians up to up through the terrorist bombing of New York City, and on and on and on. In fact, yeah. I shouldn't interrupt you. I should let you talk a minute.
Well, no, it's just you hit on so many really deep points, and a lot of them I was hoping to actually get your thoughts on there. Like when you're bringing up almost like a, it seems to me like a false dichotomy, like an unnecessary dichotomy of like, well, did you really see the griffin or did you not? Well, of course you really did, but of course you didn't, right? You
know, I love it. I love that. Okay. You're right.
Yeah. And so we don't really need those. And as far as I can tell, people of ancient times didn't need the distinction either, right? I mean, whether it was zoologically there or not, it still mattered. The image of the griffin. These kinds of, and what about it? Why do they hang on? Why do they matter so much? And you've begun to hit on that as well. And since you brought up the griffin and the phoenix, and I definitely want to dig into both of those. I'm curious about what makes the griffin hold on for so long and so many different iterations and why we keep being fascinated by it. But I am more disturbed by the phoenix. I am confused as hell. Like a lot of the other fabulous beasts, you could imagine how on maybe another planet, the thing like that would have evolved, like a griffin maybe, or even a dragon or a unicorn to some extent. But a phoenix is so idiosyncratic and odd, this life cycle of this fiery bird who will immolate itself and then rise from its own ashes or leave an egg behind to hatch from the ashes. And there's something about the phoenix and this long stretch of time, like living 777 years in some versions of it. And in one of your books, you bring forth the Apocalypse of Baruch. And that's the one that really blew my mind.
I saw that yesterday. I was enthralled. I was. It's one of my favorites. The angel says, "Let me show you the mysteries of God," or something, which is, gosh, it curls your toenails.
Yeah. And then he wants to know, like, what does the bird eat and what does it excrete?
Yes. Yes. And you mentioned the cinnamon over and over. And yeah. This was questions. What about cinnamon? In the medieval bestiaries, right behind, next entry after the phoenix, is the cinnamon bird. This is in also White's Book of Beasts, which is wonderful. Great classic. First English translation of a Latin bestiary. And it's always out in different reprints. So that's the one that follows in that bestiary and in many, many others. And with cinnamon might have been one of the spices that the phoenix uses in the nest. I really would have to look it up again. Cinnamon was for, and the cinnamon bird was first written about by Aristotle. And it's how the hunters tricked the bird by, let's see, it has the nest on a cliff, and then they hook it, and that's it, with hooks, and pull it down. Because cinnamon is so so precious, and it's a good one.
Do you think it was like the preciousness of cinnamon and the connection to that of this like transcendent bird? Or
yeah, that's part of it. hey, these animals, as in Hero of a Thousand Faces, lead you into very deep forests.
Yeah.
And they keep changing shape. They keep changing meaning. Those that I'm interested in most are those that have a very clear literary beginning, like the one you mentioned with the phoenix, which is from Herodotus, a passage that is a paragraph long and has influenced the entire tradition of that bird up to Phoenix, Arizona, with the English lord being out there in Tent City saying, hey, this is where the ancient Hohokam lived for centuries and disappeared. We build a new city on this site, and I call that Phoenix. Okay, he could not have done that. Or maybe I shouldn't say it that way. Maybe somebody other than Herodotus would have done it the first time. Anyway, you can trace it back to Herodotus. And he is not, the phoenix is not mentioned again in any elaborate form until Ovid, about 500 years after Herodotus, and on and on and on. It spirals through and takes off into so many different forms, and is thrilling. It is thrilling to follow the bird as it is for Prince Ivan following the firebird in the Russian fairy tale. That's a great one. And he does get a golden feather from that bird, who had been stealing the golden apples of, in, from the Garden of the King. And Jung, later says of Michael Mayer, in his, he was an alchemist, a quest for the phoenix and his figure, an allegorical parallel for an alchemist, young alchemist, goes around the world searching for the bird gets home and then realizes, no, it's not a one in the outer world, but is an alchemical climax for the great work transforming the prima materia, dirt and everything into spiritual or actual gold. And Jung says of Michael Mayer, well, all he had after that quest was the feather in his hand, which is, the feather.
Yeah.
It's all so exciting. I can hardly talk.
Yeah, that's sharp. That's and you're right, like your point that these things not only stay with us, but they don't stay the same. Like they keep changing. Like although, you know, you might be aware of like these, you know, martial arts dojos or academies where they have like totem animals of like tigers or dragons. Where I, as a youngster, I started attending in Evansville, Indiana, the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy.
Oh, there you go.
Our brilliant fighting coach and sensei, Jeff Westfall, I asked him about it one day, like, why the phoenix? Well, you know, why not one of these war animals that these other places seem to? And he's like, well, for me, you know, any kind of endeavor that you engage in long enough, you're going to have moments where you start learning and your ability and knowledge skyrockets, and then you plateau and even degrade, and then you rise from the ashes later on. And so it's not a continuous life. It's more like the flight of a phoenix or the life of a phoenix.
Yes. And if you look up, that was wonderful to hear. If you look up like the phoenix rising from the ashes on Google and Notre Dame Cathedral, hey, it's what, 600,000 matches or something?
Oh, that, yeah, yeah.
As it was used in the New York City parade, great parade, it gets a million onlookers. That was right after September 11. And they changed their symbol that year, very, very quickly, just a matter of a month or something, after that horrendous disaster, which has changed the doggone world.
Yeah.
It has. And so then people came out as phoenixes. Actually, there is a wonderful paragraph in the Phoenix book somewhere. Just a second.
Okay,
regarding September 11, 2001, terrorist bombings of the World Trade Center in New York City and the Pentagon in Washington. Within weeks after the attacks, New York's famed Village Halloween Parade changed its planned theme for an annual festivity. And here's the quote. What image, what myth, what spirit can lead us out of darkness towards renewal? The catastrophic events of September 11 left us all suspended in a state of remorse, anger, and powerlessness. At the Village Halloween Parade, we understood we had to rethink our plans to envision a way to address the tragedy and turn our collective energies toward the healing of New York. We looked for guidance, as the parade has always done, across the span of world cultures, and found one mythical creature who, since ancient times, has always endured destruction to rise again, the phoenix. Halloween night 2001, a gigantic papier-mâché phoenix joined other puppets and about 30,000 costumed participants, many dressed as phoenixes, in a triumphant procession down 6th Avenue, past an estimated 2 million spectators. Smoke rose in the distance from the rubble of what had been the Twin Towers. Parade organizers later said the spectacle was, quote, the first chance many New Yorkers had for a joyous mass gathering post 9/11, and to say to ourselves and the world that we are still alive and kicking.
Wow, that shoots right at the heart of why do these things matter. I mean, that clearly you have a whole city of people that you probably couldn't get to agree on almost anything in the world, and they all immediately get this fabulous beast in front of them, being this kind of this thing rising up out of all their own minds and their own history into this one transcendent kind of focal point in the phoenix. That's,
you said that so beautifully. Doggone. you.
Well, if you don't mind, I would love to hit you on one more fabulous beast, if I could, then. Because we went from the kind of you picked out probably the best application in modern times of the phoenix as this positive repository of meaning of rising up and transforming into something better or renewal. And so how about let's go dark into the dragon, which seems to be something vicious and chaotic and in need of being fought. And then the thing that burns rather than the thing that rises. And the one thing that's always fascinated me with the dragon is that, with very few exceptions, as far as I know, the dragon shows up everywhere, in all sorts of completely unrelated cultures, and throughout time. And I'm curious if you could give us some insight some of your thoughts on what's up with the dragon and why does it show up everywhere?
It is the most difficult for me to work with. I like it, of course. It's a dragon, and my gosh, there are millions of them around the world these days. But I am not able to trace it through literature and art the way I can, and have the griffin, the phoenix, the unicorn as well. And I think I won't even try, with my own words, here, but one that I, put in a PowerPoint, some museum, in Edmonton, that no longer exists, the Royal Alberta Museum, talked about dragons up there several years ago. And the first PowerPoint I showed is the meaning of the dragon, and this is from one of your great literary heroes. And you probably know the line anyway. We are as ignorant of the meaning of the dragon as we are of the meaning of the universe. But there is something in the dragon's image that appeals to the human imagination. And so we find the dragon in quite distinct places and times It is, so to speak, a necessary monster. And Ursula Le Guin says much the same thing about it being necessary.
Was that Borges? That's
Borges.
Yeah.
In the introduction to Book of Imaginary Beings. But boy, is it hard to work with. Because so much of it comes from oral tradition and then is collected in various versions over such a great amount of time there have been wonderful books about it and the evolution of the dragon and so on. Literary stuff and scholarly stuff, and then of course you have all the popular stuff. Oh my God! And Smaug, wonderful, magnificent, Smaug, terrific. I know you wrote that you would like to talk about dragons, and where does one start and where does one begin? And because the doggone thing is an Ouroboros with the tail in its mouth. I came up with a little poem of my own more than 50 years ago. The day is a dragon, starry tail in shining mouth. It crawls eternally around the world. And, that's never been printed. No.
Well, that's beautiful. It should be. that's great.
And the Ouroboros, that is how I made the map for the How to Raise and Keep a Dragon.
Yeah, because the moment you get into dragons, then you have to get into serpents, and then you're into the Ouroboros, which to me is one of the most puzzling but powerful
time
images, I think that can be.
Let me check this one second. Where were we? The Ouroboros and alchemy. Let me jump to that for just a minute, because that those wonderful comments of yours in Wondrous Birds regarding the eagle at the top of Yggdrasil.
Yeah.
The dragon down in the roots of the tree. That is alchemy. That is absolute alchemy, where it goes from the prima materia up to the culmination of very often the phoenix. Phoenix or eagle, up at the top, and the, what do you call it? The climax of alchemy. About it for, years and years.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about the two being kind of the high and low, the light and dark parallels like that in terms of alchemy either, but that's exactly right.
The philosopher's stone, for goodness sake. I would be nothing without my books, I tell you.
Same here.
come on, memory. And that was a wonderful point of yours. Yes, about the dark and the light and so on. And in the Phoenix book there is that chapter on the philosopher's stone and a graphic of the process, and you go up up to the phoenix at the top. You probably want to talk more about dragons. That's fine. But you also asked me about unicorns,
Yeah, the unicorn, that one, I think that's the only one that I haven't touched on in any of my episodes yet, because I kind of don't know what to make of it. Every time I dig into it, I get into the medieval stuff, and then I see the unicorn as Christ, but then I see the unicorn as this like sexual figure as well, and I'm kind of confused by it.
Purity, well. Welcome to the territory. Yes, of course. You know how it starts. And this is the literary beginning. Among the Indians, he proceeds, there are wild asses as large as horses, some being even larger. Their head is of a dark red color, their eyes blue, and the rest of their body white. They have a horn on their forehead, a cubit in length. The filings of this horn, if given in a potion, are an antidote to poisonous drugs. This horn, for about 2 palm breadths upwards from the base, is of the purest white, where it tapers to a sharp point of a flaming crimson, and in the middle is black. There are horns. These horns are made into drinking cups, and such as drink from them are attacked neither by convulsions nor by the sacred disease of epilepsy, etc. And it goes on to how fast the wild ass runs and so on. Well, that's Cetesius or Catesius. And, oh boy, and how do you match that with a little pink and blue unicorns on t-shirts and sweatshirts of infants.
Yeah.
This is why it is so doggone exciting, is to follow these forms that keep morphing into other things. And how and why? How did it get from the ancient traveler's tale to the Bible? It's in the bestiaries as symbol of Christ and so on. And then you have it very famously being killed by hunters in the tapestry. And then the last panel of that is it being very majestic and alive, but with a fence around it. What? My next judge is going to be entitled "What?" What?
I'm having like at least with something like the phoenix or the dragon, I feel like I can, my mind can pin down the overarching kind of or the deep roots of it. The dragon being, this hungry, burning force of chaos and many other things as well, but at least that, and the phoenix being a kind of transcendent rebirth kind of thing. And I can't pin down the unicorn. Is this wild freeness?
You're going to have to edit this conversation because I know we've run way over. But okay, if I can wrap it up with the unicorn and the questions that you just asked, about what? What is this? What is this unicorn? At this moment, the unicorn sauntered by them with his hands in his pockets. "I had the best of it this time," he said to the king, just glancing at him as he passed. A little, the king replied rather nervously. "You shouldn't have run him through with your horn, you know." "Didn't hurt me," the unicorn said carefully, and he was going on when his eye happened to fall upon Alice. He turned around instantly and stood for some time looking at her with an air of the deepest disgust. "What is this?" he said at last. "This is a child, a replied eagerly, coming in front of Alice to introduce her and spreading out both his hands towards her in an Anglo-Saxon attitude. "We only found it today. It's as large as life, and twice as natural. I always thought they were fabulous monsters," said Unicorn. "Is it alive?" "It can talk," said Hagar solemnly. The Unicorn looked dreamily at Alice and said, "Talk, child." Alice could not help her lips curling up into a smile as she began. "Do you know, I always thought unicorns were fabulous monsters, too. I never saw one alive before." "Well, now that we have seen each other," said the unicorn, "if you will believe in me, I'll believe in you. Is that a bargain?" "Yes, if you like," said Alice.
That's the best possible answer I could get. if I don't understand unicorns,
what is a monster? Yeah, what is a monster?
What in the world makes me think they'll understand me? And they're wondering the same thing, aren't they?
And that's like that wonderful story of yours about the monster, the fight, the doppelganger. Who is the? Oh God, that's a great story. That's, I can see why you have been nominated for the Pushcart Prize many times. So I really can. And
well, thank you. Well, thank you for saying so. And I've really enjoyed this. And like I said, it's been a great honor and a great pleasure. And you've been really generous with your time. I'm curious if we can maybe end off by letting listeners know of where else to find, to follow you and to find more of your works, because you had a book come out, Sea Monsters, not very long ago, right? And so, should we mention that or any other things that you have in store where, who are hearing about you can look you up and get
into the fastest
stuff?
Way is the website itself, which is, the 3 W's dot, josephnig.com, my books are in loads of libraries, and online, there are two. One's an article from wonderful art journal in Croatia. It's called Icon, is the name of the journal, I-K-O-N. And the article, this was back in 2009, I think it was 2009. Transformations of the Phoenix from the Church Fathers to the Bestiaries. That's the one. And the other is a link that I sent you, the Public Domain Review, magnificent collection of articles by wonderful writers. And that one is Olaus Magnus's Sea Serpent, those two. You had another question about the Chinese, because Sea Monsters was translated into Chinese and came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, your books are translated into many, many languages. And I forget, as far as I can tell, I've got listeners that every now and then in, say, Belgium, Germany, even South Korea. And so if you're wondering, can I get Joseph Nigg's books in other languages? Yes, you can. All sorts of languages, right? And most recently.
A letter, one of the best fan letters I ever have, a couple of years back, and I don't see it in my pile right now. But I am a reader of yours from China. I love your books. I bought the Sea Monster book in Chinese. This is the only person I've ever heard of who purchased that book. It's an actual book that somebody out there bought, for goodness sake. And I Also, purchased the Phoenix in English, but I wonder when it will be out in Chinese. It has been translated. They sent me the whole translation, and I shared a poem that my friend Joe Hutchison, current poet laureate of Colorado, wrote for my book. I shared that with him, and in Chinese. It's his first in Chinese. Far as I know, the book has not, the Phoenix has not come out yet, even though it was contracted, I don't know, what, 3 years ago or something like that. Last I heard, they had trouble getting permission for the artwork. Well, there wasn't much, not much artwork in that book because there wasn't room. And yeah, anyway, it was wonderful to hear from him. And the very, let me leap 1 second over to the very first email I got on my business email. And this was, what, 10 years ago, whatever, more than that. And it was a kid from Portugal who asked if there were any imaginary animals in Portugal. That was so charming.
Isn't
And
it?
then, of course, there have been hundreds of letters from kids wanting a dragon because I was silly enough to put addresses in How to Raise and Keep a Dragon. I that only because the British publisher said, "Oh, this is not a children's book. This is an adult spoof of how to raise books, how to raise chickens, hogs, horses." Okay, so I will. I'll go the full route of satire. I'll make up everything, and oh boy, it has led me into, some moral struggles.
Yeah, because they want to raise and keep a dragon. You told them they could do it.
The 8-year-olds will not be put off. Mothers, however, have really attacked me. And one said, "My son wrote for a Mushushu dragon in Babylon 10001, and that came back. What in the world is going on here?"
You would ask the same question,
Oh, Lordy me.
I
I'll let you go. Edit as much as you need, for goodness.
imagine.
Or maybe we could do a proper interview later that you could use. This one
No, I think.
goes nowhere. It goes nowhere and everywhere. And
Well, I think it's wonderful, and I've enjoyed the hell out of it, and so I have a good feeling my listeners will as well. And we've hit on a point that you've made in one way or another several times now, which I think is probably the biggest answer to the biggest question I have. Essentially, I think your own books are a great example of this, that in an era of kind of a whole lot of turmoil and uncertainty and perhaps defined more by division than anything else, what is more unifying and what is more
that's what.
both what's more diverse and unifying than Fabulous Beasts? And these kind of fabulous monsters that children from Portugal, adults from China, Weird guys from me, from, you know, sitting in here in the middle of Illinois, we can all understand a dragon, and we get a dragon. We all get sea monsters. A whole city can come together under a phoenix. And so there is something absolutely meaningful about these things. And when we need a guide for that meaning, I think there is none better than yourself, sir. So I really appreciate getting to talk with you.
Oh, boy. You know what I would like, Josh, is that we would collaborate on the Fabulous Beast thing book with the next edition, with you providing the explanations, the questions, and the commentary. God, you do wonderfully.
You don't have to ask me twice. That's an automatic yes. That'd be wonderful.
Okay, if we ever have a chance, you're on, kid.
Fantastic. Sign me up. That would be great. Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been a real hoot. Thank you. Really made my day.
Well, I think one final time, thank you again so much, sir. It's been a great honor and a great pleasure.